The story of how Bell became AT&T has it all. Two fundamental patents filed by Alexander Graham Bell, giving one company an airtight monopoly on the next big thing. A historic, miraculously timed deal taking out that company's only possible competitor. Then a brilliant, high-risk series of consolidations to put together a nationwide long-distance network. It came together to make the biggest company in modern history. In this video, we look back at how AT&T forged a monopoly. The story begins with the February 1876 patent filed by Alexander Graham Bell. And right from the get-go, there was controversy. The patent filing dispute between Bell and Elisha Gray, an inventor and co-founder of Western Electric, is famous. There are allegations of theft dating to Gray's notice of a pending application, and whether Bell modified his application because of it, whether Gray's machine would have worked, so on. Let's set that aside. In the end, Bell got his fundamental telephone patents, the first in 1876 covering the fundamental concept, then a second granted a year later covering the magnetic telephone in great detail. These two fundamental patents, said to be the most valuable patents ever issued in American history, later became the cornerstone of a new company called the Bell Telephone Company in 1877. I shall keep to calling the company in its future iterations. There will be several, just Bell, to keep us all sane. Alexander Graham Bell, the person, worked there as a salaried electrician and consultant. He continued his work for the deaf and left the company's business operations to his father-in-law, Gardiner Hubbard. Hubbard was also one of the founders of the National Geographic Society, which is kind of interesting. Early on, the Bell Telephone Company lacked the capital to develop, build, and run a massive network and provide equipment. So Hubbard came up with a capital-light business model that granted independent local entrepreneurs the exclusive right to set up and run their own regional telephone network franchises, later called Bell Operating Companies. These were kind of like car dealership or fast food franchises, receiving exclusivity for some local region. To source the equipment for their franchisees, Bell licenses patents to the workshop of Alexander's friend, Charles William Jr. The workshop made the telephone receiver and transmitter, which Bell bought, and then leased to the franchisees. So the Bell Company's money and profits did not come from directly operating local telephone connections, though they might own significant equity stakes in these franchisees. Rather, it came from leasing out the telephone equipment to those franchisees for their users. Bell Operating Companies paid Bell about $14 per year, or about $419 today, for their telephone equipment lease, a cost they then passed on to the user. Since the equipment only cost Bell about $4 or $120 today to make, there was considerable margin to enjoy. This, however, required upfront cash, and it might take an extended period of time, years even, to earn back that investment. Moreover, the whole business model seemingly depended on the patent's validity. The Bell Telephone Company's most formidable challenger was the telegraph giant Western Union. It is said that in 1876, shortly after the Bell patent was filed, the company ran short on cash, so Hubbard supposedly offered to sell the patents to Western Union for $100,000, which is worth about $3 million today. But Western Union and its president, William Orton, turned it down. Thomas Watson, yes, that same Watson who Alexander Bell famously first called, recalled 40 years after the fact that the offer was refused, quote, somewhat contemptuously, end quote. Many people, historians included, claim that this refusal was because Western Union saw the telephone as a toy or some passing fad. The truth is probably a bit more complicated. There are no corporate records in either company of a formal offer ever being made. We only have Watson's 40-year-old recollections and a second-hand reference via Orton's successor. And Western Union's actions at the time show that they very much cared about telephony. They started developing a telephone in 1875 and later famously gave Thomas Edison $500 a month to produce a talking telegraph. If an offer was indeed given and refused, it must have been because Western Union thought Bell's machine would not work and were instead betting on Elisha Gray's patents. They were then working with Gray to establish Gray & Barton, a company that would later become Western Electric, the country's largest electronics company. The partnership between Western Union and Western Electric would be formidable. The telephone's first rental customer was Alexander Graham Bell's personal friend Roswell Downer, a prestigious banker. Downer obviously loved the thing, and his endorsement kicked off a flood of orders of what was previously just a curiosity. Despite a limited range, and then only being able to connect two fixed points, the early telephone quickly became valued as a private line for businesses and wealthy individuals. Businesses especially valued it because it removed the need to have a human telegraph operator send and receive sensitive messages. Private lines were okay, but then in January 1878, one of the Bell operating companies, the Boston Telephone Dispatch Company, installed a central switchboard based on their experiences with nighttime burglar alarms. Switchboards let human operators in a central exchange connect any two telephones on the network, an immense value, and they quickly replaced private line services. Companies rushed to sign up people to their networks. The telephone was on its way. Bell's business model required them to make enough telephone equipment to meet demand, upgrade them when new technologies came about, and also repair them as needed. Charles Williams Jr.'s little workshop struggled to deliver on this promise. Customers, Bell operating companies, and sales agents complained about intolerable delays in instruments, switchboards, and telephones. Embarrassed, they urged Bell to find more reliable and timely suppliers. In response, Williams tried to ramp up, expanding the workforce and adding more equipment. He complained about Bell not reliably paying his invoices and claimed that he was filling orders on time. These production issues were indicative of Bell's struggles to transition from a simple patent licensing organization taking royalties into an actual operating company serving an entire nation. Yes, I know it's hard to imagine the future AT&T has a startup. The company's trustee was Hubbard. He was then handling all the office stuff, contracts, royalty payments, and correspondence with partners, in particular assuring those partners that the Bell fundamental patents were solid enough to build a business on. Such work was beyond one person. Seeing this, Western Union jumped into the telephone business too. Being some 15 times larger than the Bell Company and in possession of their own large network, they competed ferociously, easily undercutting Bell's rates and bullying Bell's associates to defect. Moreover, their telephone equipment worked better, thanks to its ongoing partnership with Thomas Edison. Most notably, Edison had patented, though not necessarily invented, the carbon granule microphone. The microphone had two metal plates separated by carbon granules. During operation, sound waves cause the thinner plate diaphragm to vibrate. This modulates an electrical signal to make it similar to the original sound wave. Pretty cool, right? Anyway, the Bell Telephone Company's fierce competition with Western Union and its own cash-heavy business model drained their finances and forced them to turn to outside financing. They had already done one such event back before in February 1878, but the money quickly ran out. For this next one, the investors asked Hubbard to find a new general manager. Hubbard chose an ambitious former telegraph operator named Theodore Newton Vail. Vail was a cousin of Alfred Vail, who worked with Samuel Morse himself to commercialize the telegraph. Theo Vail later joined the U.S. government as the respected and very competent superintendent of the Railway Mail Service. After a dispute over his daily expenses, Vail quit in a huff and joined Bell in 1878. Hubbard convinced Vail of the vision of bringing universal telephone service across the whole nation, and unlike Hubbard, Vail had the administrative competence to achieve it. In February 1879, another recapitalization created the reconstituted and renamed National Bell Telephone Company. Another in 1880 renamed the company again to the American Bell Telephone Company. I shall just keep calling it Bell. Vail started cleaning up the company, bringing structure and solving problems. First and most urgently, Bell had to deal with Western Union's intense competition, which could lead to a takeover and assimilation by the larger entity. Boldly, Vail took them to court for patent infringement, and unexpectedly, Western Union crumpled. In November 1879, the two parties settled. Western Union recognized that Bell's patents were primary. Bell also got Western Union's telephone operations and patents in exchange for Bell's stock. And finally, the two agreed to stay out of each other's businesses. This was a history-defining move that removed Bell's biggest competitor, and it's a bit confusing. Bell's patents were then untested, and Western Union had a growing telephone business, better equipment, and the financial wherewithal to tie Bell up in endless litigation. Why stop? Two big reasons. First, and most importantly, in mid-1879, the vicious and widely reviled railroad magnate Jay Gould began a hostile takeover attempt of Western Union. Gould started a competing company, American Union, and used his money and railroad holdings to drive down Western Union's stock prices. At the same time, he was secretly buying shares of the company. Gould was willing to join forces with Bell and fund their infringement lawsuit to the gills, so settling helped Western Union focus on fending off Gould, a defense that failed, by the way. Gould eventually got Western Union, and his family would hold it for many years afterward. The second big reason to settle, Bell's patents turned out to be airtight. Even Western Union's experienced patent lawyers realized this, though they also believed that their own patents could fight Bell to a standstill. Years later, several Supreme Court cases in 1887 and 1888 narrowly agreed to uphold Bell's fundamental patents. This let Bell use those patents throughout the decade to suppress competition. One example was the 1884 infringement lawsuit that shut down the small but growing Baxter Overland Telephone and Telegraph Company, with its 300 subscribers in New York. The 1880s saw many a wildcat exchange pop up and then get sued into oblivion. Over their 17 years of validity and despite nearly 600 lawsuits and proceedings, challengers never managed to invalidate the fundamental Alexander Bell telephone patents. In his 1879 settlement, Western Union got $1 a year for each telephone for as long as the patents were valid, plus about $2.5 million of Bell stock, which was not particularly bad, but Western Union sold that stock too early to expand their telegraph network and pay their 6% dividends. And unfortunately, Western Union did not ask for a share in the regional Bell operating companies. That was a short-term financial oversight that they later unsuccessfully sued Bell for to get back. More seriously, in the long term, they failed to prevent Bell from providing long-distance telephone service between regions. Could they really have stopped them? Probably not. Nevertheless, this mistake would eventually cost them their telegraph business. Now it was time to figure out some way to deal with the manufacturing issues, namely the struggling Williams workshop. Different sides inside Bell engaged in a vivid debate. Williams was a Bell shareholder. He and his employees knew how to build high-quality telephones, which Bell saw as a hallmark of their offering and a competitive advantage against Western Union. However, he was falling short in the challenge of scaling up the business and mastering the mass production of a new, better-sounding transmitter, the Blake transmitter created by the inventor Francis Blake. This weighed heavily on poor Williams Jr., and by February 1879, he was delivering just 35 telephones a day. If Bell, the company, wanted to be a professional corporation serving an entire nation, then they could not solely rely on a tiny shop run by one of Alexander Bell's friends. Thusly, in the summer of 1879, they granted manufacturing licenses to several new factories in four cities, which temporarily alleviated the problem. Shortly afterwards, a new opportunity emerged, almost literally fell into their laps, the Western Electric Company. Western Electric was then the nation's largest maker of fine electrical apparatus, making typewriters, sewing machines, the like. They were not only very large, but technically proficient as well, capable of making equipment that Bell otherwise struggled to produce, like cables and telephone equipment. Western Electric worked closely with Western Union in competing against Bell, a connection forged less on stock holdings but rather a personal connection between their leaders and money. The alliance was very profitable for Western Electric. From 1877 to 1880, their annual sales grew from $277,000 to $877,000. But the 1879 agreement that ended Western Union's involvement in telephones also cut off Western Electric from that lucrative business. Not wanting to miss out on the fast-growing telephone business, Western Electric's president Anson Steger contacted Vail in 1880 for a telephone manufacturing license. By then, Bell had no urgent need for more manufacturing capacity, but Western Electric held patents that Bell knew could be wielded against them. One particular set could hit their new Bulacke transmitters. Western Electric quickly intuited this interest during the meeting and demanded a manufacturing license in exchange for them. As Bell mulled this over, two new developments morphed things from just a business deal to a full acquisition. First, in January 1881, Jay Gould completed his secret hostile takeover of Western Union. He promptly booted all the old management, essentially severing the connection with Western Electric. Left out in the cold, Western Electric needed to do something. So, in March 1881, they bought a 61% stake in the Gilliland Company. That factory was one of Bell's four new workshops, and by far its most important and innovative. This was a sharp move by Anson Steger to get Bell to do a deal, or else. What followed was a two-year-long, complicated exchange that saw Western Electric first merge with Gilliland and Williams Jr.'s factories, then sold to Bell for a license and cash, and then recapitalized. For several years afterwards, Western Electric operated largely independently of Bell. Bell ordered equipment, and Western Electric shipped it. They continued making vacuum lamps, electric lighting, and dynamos alongside the telephones and exchange equipment. Over the years, however, Western Electric narrowed its focus to just telephones and exchange equipment, and in doing so, they became the crux of Bell's vertical integration strategy and a powerful weapon in the competitions ahead. In the minds of Bell's management, a pair of dates loomed, 1893 and 1894. In those years, Bell's two fundamental patents on telephony will expire, and the company will lose its legal monopoly on its core products. Over the years, Bell had grown incredibly unpopular as this monopolistic toll-taking troll, stealing hard-earned money from the pockets of ordinary people. Worse yet, telephone rates kept going up. In the days before automated exchanges, more subscribers to an exchange meant hiring more operators to handle them. That in turn meant higher costs, which were passed on to the users. So every 100 new subscribers meant a $5 rate increase. Bell managers quietly warned their Bell operating companies that not dealing with this will cause, quote, continual conflict with the public, end quote. And oh, there was conflict, all right. To the public, this made no sense. How can expansion mean higher rates? Yet with Bell slapping down every potential alternative under the sun, the public had no choice but to call for boycotts that did not work and legislation that never came. In the end, they could do nothing but just take it and wait for those patents to expire. For Bell, this meant a monstrous tidal wave of competition ahead of them. What can they do to prepare for it? Vail joined Bell with the goal of Bell's telephone service being this high-priced, high-quality service for businesses wanting to communicate over long distances. But during the 1880s and early 1890s, Bell struggled to get a suitable long-distance service off the ground, and for fair reasons. Telephony technology then was quite unreliable and did not transmit sound very well over a span of 20-plus miles. This changed, somewhat, after the late 1880s with the broad adoption of copper metallic circuits, which worked better than iron ones, and improved transmitters. Even so, a subscriber had to visit the central office downtown to make a long-distance call. Just sending a telegram was cheaper and easier. The Bell franchisees then ran their businesses with great independence, and so were reluctant to invest their time and money into this folly. Where was the demand? A manager in one such company, the Southern New England Telephone Company in New Haven, mocked this by saying, "It was almost suggested that the life of the average American would be incomplete were he to omit from his daily routine the pleasure of telephoning to his friends in Japan." Nevertheless, Vail valued long distance so much so that in 1885 they set up a subsidiary underneath Bell called the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T, to build and operate long lines between the city exchanges in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Vail became president of AT&T, but soon afterwards quit both that and his position as general manager of American Bell when he was not made president of the latter. He spent the next few years traveling the world. For 17 years, Bell largely funded its expansion out of retained earnings, which meant that growth came about slowly but profitably. In 1884, there were over 7,000 towns in America with over 10,000 people. Bell had put exchanges in just 52 of them. From 1885 to 1894, Bell grew its total number of telephone stations by just 6.3% each year. Investment in plants also grew just a humble 8.2% each year. This made this growth profitable, garnering an average return on investment of 46%. That all changed when the Alexander Graham Bell fundamental patents first began to expire in 1893. They unleashed a flood of independent as a non-Bell affiliated telephone networks. The first areas they served were those without a pre-existing Bell network, often started and promoted by the local community itself. In the 451 medium-sized cities where a Bell network already existed, the newcomers undercut Bell's monopoly rates. This build-out supercharged telephone adoption. In 1895, there were just 4.8 telephones per 1,000 Americans. In 1900, that leapt to 17.6 telephones. 1907, that had exploded to 69.6 telephones. Bell felt that it had no choice but to accelerate their build-out and lower their rates. In 1895, the average Bell station made $88. 12 years later, in 1905, that was $43. And from 1895 to 1906, the annual growth in American Bell telephone stations quickened to 21%. At the same time, Bell and AT&T began building up its long-distance network. They had a New York City to Boston line that opened in 1884 and expanded from there. New York City to Albany and Buffalo, Boston to Washington, D.C., so on. Even so, the independents were rapidly catching up. In 1907, American Bell remained the largest network with 3.1 million telephone stations, but the independents had 3 million too. Almost immediately, the newcomers wanted connection to Bell's larger network. Bell, AT&T, and their associated companies, sometimes referred to as the Bell System, decided to deny these newcomers access both to its long-distance network and to its equipment. Many saw this as anti-competitive. As the various sides prepared to take this to court, two major changes in Bell. One was organizational. In 1900, the shareholders of American Bell, based in Boston, and AT&T, based in New York City, swapped shares. This made AT&T the parent company of the Bell System and was an indication of the management's changing profile. Stock dilution over the years had caused its Boston shareholders to lose their grip on the board. New York City, then, made more sense as an environment friendlier to business. The company had also attracted the attention of the American banking titan J.P. Morgan. He saw this, quote, excess competition, like the railroad and telegraph industries before, as wasteful and sought to end it. After a struggle with rival bankers, J.P. Morgan and his cohorts would take control of AT&T in 1907. The second major development was technological, kind of. As the race to connect America developed, AT&T and the independents started researching ways to improve the quality of long-distance service. And in 1899, a brilliant Serbian-American engineer patented a marvelous invention that made long-distance telephone a practical reality. That very famous Serbian-American engineer? Michael Pupin. Sorry, Tesla fans. A professor at Columbia, Pupin patented the loading coil, sometimes called the Pupin coil. Capacitance forming between the parallel telephone wires hurts their ability to carry high-frequency signals like voices. Over long distances, you get signal loss or attenuation, which is bad. Periodically inserting Pupin coils into the cable reduces that capacitance, doubling the range of long-distance calls from 800 to 1,700 miles. This remained the way to do long distance until the invention of the vacuum tube-based amplifier a few years later. Pupin beat out a member of AT&T's research staff to win the patent, so AT&T paid Pupin $455,000, or $17.5 million today, for them. In buying the Pupin patents, AT&T technologically locked out the independents from providing anything more than local service. In 1907, J.P. Morgan's firm finally got control of AT&T and removed the old Boston owners. Theodore Vail returned to the company he had once run and left many years earlier. He and Morgan decided to stop spending so much on competing, competing was for losers anyway, and instead tried to acquire and consolidate the sprawling industry. So AT&T started acquiring independent telephone companies, who saw selling out as a way of escaping intense competition and potential financial ruin, especially after the Panic of 1907. In 1912 alone, AT&T acquired 136,000 telephone stations. The most significant acquisition was a 30% controlling stake in Western Union. Jay Gould's less competent son, George, had to sell it after losing a lot of money during that very same panic. Buying Western Union gave AT&T access to valuable railroad properties, stocks in local telephone exchanges, and special advertising assets like billboards. Ironically enough, it also revitalized Western Union, which benefited from organizational updates and technology upgrades, from Morse to printing telegraphs. Second, Vail struck interconnection agreements with major independent telephone companies. The defections not only added to AT&T's own network of subscribers, but also crippled the independents' ability to assemble a competing long-distance network of their own. Together, this strategy of acquiring an interconnection slowly whittled down the number of towns with more than one choice of telephone service. Lastly, Vail began a new system of centralization. He and his chief engineer, John Carty, harmonized the various Bell operating companies, making them give up their, quote, excessive and uneconomic diversity, end quote, and adopt AT&T's technologies and engineering practices. And realizing the importance of producing new innovations ahead of the competition, Vail and Carty also centralized company-wide R&D, founding what will eventually be known as Bell Labs. AT&T was now starting to look like a single centralized entity, the one most older people are familiar with today-ish. In 1911, Vail began rolling out nationwide advertisements declaring the competitive strategy, universal service. AT&T's attempts to acquire independence and eliminate competition were strongly resisted. Complaints to the U.S. Attorney General led to a lawsuit to stop this predatory action, and in 1913, AT&T delivered its Kingsbury Commitment to the U.S. government. AT&T agreed to sell Western Union and stop buying up independent telephone companies in areas of telephone competition. Note, though, Kingsbury did not prevent AT&T from acquiring companies in non-competing areas. So between 1913 and 1917, they bought 241,000 more stations while selling 58,000. Kingsbury also obligated AT&T to connect willing telephone companies to their long-distance network so long as the system requirements were met, something the independents had at first wanted, but later realized led to assimilation. In the years afterwards, state telephone commissions began regulating how service was built out and priced. After 1907, Vail and the bankers started to embrace the idea of being regulated, aware of the corporate benefits it provided. Then during World War I, the United States nationalized the Bell system. The difficulty they had in running the network convinced the American government of the rightness of having a single monopoly. So in 1921, after the war ended, the U.S. government essentially released AT&T from the Kingsbury Commitment with the Willis-Graham Act of 1921, allowing AT&T to go acquire independent telephone companies. And AT&T finished the job. Throughout the 1920s, they acquired over 200 independent telephone companies to get 80% of local exchange customers, 92% of equipment sales, and 100% of long-distance traffic. AT&T now had its monopoly. Looking back at it many years later, Theodore Vail would claim that it had all been planned from the very beginning. Writing in 1918, he claimed, "From the commencement of the business, one system, one policy, universal service is branded on the business in the most distinctive terms." Such testimony sort of twists things, I think. Vail's vision back in the 1880s did not mean bringing the telephone to every person in the United States, but rather replicating the long-distance networks of the telegraph, which was fair because that was his previous line of work, and the telegraph, along with the railroad, was the only historical metaphor he could have followed at the time. But the telephone went on to surpass Vail's original vision, especially during the explosion of competition after its patents expired. But the company quickly adapted, and as the industry matured, they imposed an orderliness on top of it that will reign for another half century. All right, everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.